Today's episode of Darkness Radio is brought to you by Microdose. Get out of pain, get out of anxiety, and start treating yourself a little bit better. Try Microdose. Microdose is a CBD THC gummy that will get you out of pain, get you out of anxiety, and get you into feeling good again. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com and use the code DARKNESS to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdose.com, code DARKNESS. Welcome in, everybody, to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Got a good show for you this day, and I'll tell you, I'll start it here in a moment. We have a fascinating topic and a fascinating person to talk to today. We're going to go down the wild and wacky world of the weird, unexplained, and bizarre. We're going to talk with author Charles Christian here in just a few moments. We're going to talk about everything from the Wold Newton Triangle to werewolves, zombies, vampires, green-skinned fairy folk, headless ghosts, screaming skulls, ancient warlords, parkin-eating dragon, so much more. We've got a lot on tap today. Folks, I want to tell you a little bit about a movie I saw last night. Got to check out a screening last night of the new Jordan Peele film, Nope. I can give you a one-word review of this movie, sure. Yep, I'd go see it again. It's a good movie. You know what? There are very few classic American filmmakers left, I think, in America. I mean, that are actually, you know, good storytellers. And we could argue amongst ourselves for quite a while as to who those American storytellers are that are good. I do count Jordan Peele among them. Some people don't, which is a shame because he is a very good storyteller. I'll tell you, though, between you, me, and the fence post, this movie does fall apart for me towards the end. That is a little bit of a spoiler of the review. Towards the end of the review. Just keep that in mind as we talk a little bit about the movie. But the premise is real simple in that, you know, we talk about things that are bigger than ourselves and the horror that exists within that. And really, what do we do when there's something that's bigger than us that in circumstances that we can't control? And those type of movies are absolutely terrifying. And Jordan Peele is really good in fleshing that out in this movie. It really doesn't matter what the catalyst is, although you pretty much get an idea of what it is when you see the previews of this movie in that big alien ship that you see coming from the sky. And it is impressive. I'll give you that. Although it does look like in some parts of the movie, it looks like maybe Jordan ran out of money a little bit about halfway through the movie and that the studio wouldn't give him any more. So they had to cut the special effects budget a little short. But even then, the storytelling is very good. The script is very good. The acting is very good. Kiki Palmer is very good in this movie as she plays the sister in this movie. The premise is this, is that there's a brother and sister that have to take over the horse handling business for Hollywood movies from their father, who dies in the beginning of the movie. I won't reveal how. It's shocking nonetheless. But it gets us going on our journey in that the ranch that they own, that they raise these horses and handle them and train them for these Hollywood films. And by the way, they were the first horse handling firm in Hollywood ever, black owned, in the history of Hollywood. This tragedy with their father is threatening to pull them apart and threatening to shut them down because they didn't run it as well as Pop did. So in that process, they also have a man who runs like a, like the old carnival sideshow Wild West sideshows like you would see in Virginia City, in Nevada. And that character is played by Steven Yeun, who's a former child actor who his last role was in a sitcom Gone Wrong, where a chimpanzee got loose and actually killed some of the actors on set. And you see that in the very beginning of the movie. And that kind of ties into everything else. And Jordan Peele does a brilliant job of tying those two storylines together and somehow making sense of the antagonist in our movie, which is this alien ship, which comes to this valley where the two of these characters exist. And I'll go just a little bit further into the movie, and that the brother and the sister, as Pop has passed away, are realizing that they can't survive after they try to go on an audition for the job and realize they're not cut of the same cloth as Pop. And the brother and the sister realize that they have to sell horses to Steven Yeun's character, which is running this Wild West sideshow. I'll leave it at that, and I'll leave you in that care and not go any further with the rest of the movie. Meanwhile, this alien is flying over the entire valley and wreaking havoc with both areas, and I'll leave it there. Like I said, I'm impressed with the storytelling because the characters are rich. The story is rich. And you really do have to kind of key in. And it's not hard to key into the story at all. It's easy to follow. For me, at least it was. And it's intriguing. It's intriguing the lessons that are there too, about not just about us, but it's a lesson in what we would do or what we do when we're confronted with panic, and what we're confronted with when we're dealing with an animal that's bigger than us. And there's a lot of animal references in this movie. I mean, there's animals all over the place. There's horses, there's chimps, there's all kinds of animals. And it has to deal with the animal within ourselves as well, which is quite interesting. It's a study in animals and humans and nature in general. A brilliant movie up until the end. And there's, to me, and again, no spoilers, but there's a huge logic flaw for me in the end, which to me kind of threw me sideways. So it affected how I rate the movie. But otherwise, I thought it was a brilliant movie. If with that, it affects my rating. My rating of the movie, I give it a 3.5 out of 5. But I still thought it was a brilliant movie. And that about wraps up a little bit about Nope and what I saw last night there at the theater. Let's turn our attention now to our guest for today. Our guest for today is Charles Christian, who is an English barrister and writer's correspondent turned writer, podcaster, award-winning tech journalist, and sometimes werewolf hunter. Yes, you heard me right, werewolf hunter. He now writes, talks, and makes videos mainly about folklore, urban myths, history, and the weird. And yes, an English Fleet Street newspaper once did commission on him to go on a werewolf hunt. We'll talk about that on the night of a full moon. I'm not going to give you the spoiler alert on it, however. I want to go through the story, and we'll find out with him. He was born a chime child with a call, so according to legend, he cannot drown at sea, but can see and talk to ghosts and fairy folk without fear of coming to harm. This is allegedly. This is another topic I want to talk to him about. Whether you're a skeptic or a believer, does Charles Christian personally believe in ghosts? We'll find out about that. The weird and paranormal. His answer is the same as the celebrated ghost and supernatural horror writer M.R. James gave in the preface to a collection of his short stories about 100 years ago. He says, "I am prepared to consider the evidence and accept it if it satisfies me." This is going to be an interesting conversation. He's the author of A Travel Guide to Yorkshire's Weird Worlds, The Mysterious Wold Newton Triangle, and Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England. His latest book is Shuckland, Weird Tales, Ghosts, Folklore, and Legends from East Anglia's, I believe it's, is it Waveney Valley?
It is Waveney, yes.
Okay. Volume 1 of a new haunted landscape series, and he's currently writing an almanac of real witches and sorcerers along with other practitioners of magic, black and white, from earlier times through until the modern era. I'll get that out, Charles. Let's welcome to Darkness Radio, Charles Christian. Hello, Charles. Welcome into the program. We appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me on, Tim.
I don't quite know where to start with it. You know what? Let's start with the werewolf story, shall we? Let's hit him with a bang right away. You know, yesterday, as Bruiser and I were getting off the air doing Supernatural News, he couldn't help it because he's so into cryptids. And he said to me, "Werewolf Hunter, you're having on a real werewolf hunter." And I almost wanted to bring him on today. He had stuff he had to get done today. And he said, you know, he was just chomping at the bit to want to be on today with you. Because he said, "Well, ask him how many cases he's been on." I said, "I think it's only been one, Bruiser." Tell us, Charles, a little bit about this werewolf hunter or hunting fascination. Was it only one case? Has it been many cases? Straighten us out a little bit about this and what happened.
Right. Well, a long time ago, I wrote a book about the folklore of part of Yorkshire, the Wold Newton Triangle, which you referred to recently, mm-hmm. just a few moments ago. Mm-hmm. And one of the tales in there from a village close to where I grew up is about a werewolf called Old Stinker. And called Old Stinker because it has a putrid breath, because werewolves are supposed to eat carrion, among other things, you know, dig up bodies from graves and so on. And it was a medieval tale, and this werewolf was said to haunt this particular part of the countryside and was a proper shapeshifter. It would be a human by day and would lurk around villages and market towns and notice any travelers. And then at night, it would revert into a wolf-like form and it would be joined by a pack of other wolves, and they would hunt down any travelers who were heading home along this particular area of England. As I said, we're talking 1,000 years ago, and it was a bleak, marshy area. And in fact, in history, the area was plagued with wolves, real wolves, to the extent that a hostel was built precisely to give people somewhere to stay overnight. And the charter for the hostel says, so they aren't eaten by wolves. So, you know, we've got a mixture of real history there and this tale of Old Stinker the werewolf. Okay. Old Stinker does crop up a couple more times in history in the sort of 18th century, and then more recently, I was conscious of it when I was a teenager, so 1960s, there was a report of a lorry driver being attacked by driving in his truck, being attacked by a huge wolf-like creature. And one of the features of it was that the wolf had huge orangey-red glowing eyes. Mm. And this coincided with the tales of the werewolf from medieval times. Fast forward to the present day, and about 5 years ago, there were reports in a town called Hull, which is only about 30 miles from where the medieval wolf used to prowl, that there was a wolf-like creature haunting and lurking and attacking other animals down a particular waterway. It was a sort of disused canal in a sort of derelict area of the town. And a newspaper journalist who'd read my book about it phoned me up because, you know, I was the only person in that part of the world who'd written anything about werewolves recently, and asked me what I thought. And I rather jokingly said, "It sounds like Old Stinker's come back from the undead and is now prowling there." And lo and behold, it took off and became a bit of an internet phenomenon for good 3 months. And there were lots of sightings of the werewolf, or supposedly a werewolf, and the tales got more and more elaborate, including the fact that it wore check trousers, which is slightly odd.
Yeah.
It took off, and newspapers, radio stations, local TV all got excited about it, and it culminated in myself and a couple of other people, including my wife, not quite sure what she deserved to do it, get involved, being asked by a newspaper to go on a werewolf hunt, which started appropriately enough at midnight in an abandoned churchyard. And we then spent a couple of hours working our way along this derelict canal looking for anything werewolf-likey.
Wow. So, okay, let's dig into it then. So you're, first of all, okay, so you say it sounds like Old Stinker, and everybody goes, so there's some sort of precedent for this thing, and then
exactly
everybody jumps into it, and we know about this because yesterday on Supernatural News, and I'm going to draw a little bit of a weird parallel to this here, Charles. Yesterday on Supernatural News, I'm reading a Reddit post from 10 days ago about the James Webb Space Telescope. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, the modern day fairy tale you're going to start to hear about here in the next couple of weeks. Supposedly there's a guy who worked at NASA who said that, you know, the James Webb Space Telescope has been operational since February, according to him, and that they've spotted something that looks like, for lack of a better term, it's a space plant that is snuffing out stars left and right, and it's growing, and it's shooting out these tendrils that are snuffing out stars. And the reason it's doing this is it's feeding off the energy from these stars. And it's, as it's snuffing out stars, whole worlds are freezing. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's kind of nightmare fuel, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. And as NASA is taking a look through this telescope, this high power telescope, it notices that one of the tendrils is shooting its way towards us. And it says, how many years do we have left? And one of the young men at NASA that's trying to figure it out says, well, sir, as it's traveling in light years, because they're figuring it out in light years, how fast this thing is traveling in this little, you know, Dyson sphere, it says, we have about 27 years. So, So I mean, you talk about, fiction and how fiction can spread quickly through the internet, just like you said,
yeah,
or how it spreads quickly amongst people, from whether it be from olden days in books and in literature or by mouth to now internet, and people go, is it or is it not?
Exactly.
And now you have this modern day Old Stinker, and people are going, wait a minute, Charles, come down to this little canal and see if you can find Old Stinker for us, because he may be wearing check pants and running around and actually trying to get one of us. So they've got you down in this canal now, and you're rooting around looking for Old Stinker. I got to ask you, what do you bring to a werewolf hunt to try and hunt down a werewolf? I mean, what in modern day times, what do you bring with you to actually bring this thing down? I mean, we know in lore what we think will bring down a werewolf, but in modern day times, honestly, what do you think brings down a werewolf?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that, because I did do some research on it. And obviously, one qualification is, here in the UK, we have very, 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 very strict gun laws. Mm-hmm. So carrying a gun filled with silver bullets, which is, the popular method, is just not on.
Yeah.
And indeed, it's intriguing, because a lot of the werewolf lore stems from a couple of 1930s movies, the Wolfman and the Werewolf of London. I think it is two Lon Chaney movies. Mm-hmm. And they are the first ones that have the werewolf being shot by the silver bullet and then transforming back into the human. I also did a lot of reading on other things. And if you go way back, the Germans, back in the medieval period, they were quite obsessed with werewolves. And they had, whereas the rest of Europe were having witch trials, the Germans were having werewolf trials, and people were being dragged out and accused of being werewolves. And their view was that it's basically a very big, powerful, scary wolf, and that you would deal with it the same way you would deal with a flesh and bones wolf. And so, you know, there's woodcuts of them chasing him down with spears and shooting arrows at them and everything else. So my view was, I really didn't think we were going to encounter a werewolf. I like the tale about it, and it's a fascinating story, but I really thought a werewolf was not going to be a viable creature we were going to meet. However, I did occur to me it might be a roaming loose, very large dog. So I had a very large stick with a point on one end and a sort of club-like handle on the other end, to fight me off, should it do. But I say, when you read about a lot of the things in folklore about dealing with werewolves, they aren't actually that practical. You know, some of them are, you plant houses around, you plant certain herbs around your home so the werewolf won't come into your garden. Well, obviously that's not really much use if you're on the move somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, there's certain other plants that can be used, but they are toxic and you're more likely to poison yourself than you are to poison anything else. And, you know, stabbing a werewolf through, I read one report, it said, you take a silver dagger and you stab the werewolf through the heart. Well, a silver dagger is not very strong. And getting up close and personal to stab a werewolf through the heart, you're a little bit too close than you'd want to be.
Right.
Even if it was a normal wolf, you'd still be an awful lot closer than you'd want to be. So right. I took the view that a very large, stout, heavy stick with a point on one end and a club on the other end would be what we'd need.
Right. Yeah. By the time you get that close to stab a werewolf, you're pretty much in trouble, and you're probably going to have
exactly.
Your throat ripped
out. Yeah. All the reports say how big they are. And, you know, if a wolf stands on its, a normal wolf stands on its hind legs, which they can do, and puts its paws out, it's got quite a lot of reach there. It's, you know, it's a big thing. And, I certainly wouldn't want to be that close to one of them.
Here in Minnesota, we have timber wolves. We have the actual wolf, which is be quite dangerous, and then we have the basketball team, which isn't dangerous to anybody. So you know, there's two different kinds there. Now let's set the scene a little bit here with you personally, here, Charles. Let's get a little bit into you, because I find it fascinating as we're reading your bio that you say you're a bit of a chime child, yet you grew up in a haunted house, or a spooky house rather, in the north of England.
Yeah.
So let's get a little bit into that and figure out how things shake out with you. And let's start first with growing up in that spooky house in the north of England. Start with the beginning of your beginning.
Yeah. Well, I say my parents had a business, a shop, on the harbour side in a north of England coastal town, mainly a holiday resort now, called Scarborough. And our house was so close to the harbour that there was a road between us and the harbour. But when we had very large high tides, our cellars used to flood. And it was one of those houses that had, as the foreshore had been developed and built up, they'd stuck more and more bits on the house. But if you went way back, you found the medieval part, and we know there was sections we found, we know, with the timbers, with the infill in them, and walls that were 3 or 4 feet thick. So, you know, it was medieval, and because bits had been added onto it, it was a very unusual. It's a sort of thing that H.P. Lovecraft would say was built to non-Euclidean geometry. You'd go down a corridor and it would just stop. And then there'd be a doorway that would swing open. And then there was a cellar there. It was, you know, it made no sense at all as the building. So it was redolent in atmosphere. And at the time when I was a child, we still had an attic under a pan-tiled roof. It was later removed because it was collapsing. But we used to hear odd thumping noises above our bedrooms. And the story my parents told me was just seagulls on the roof, you know. Seagulls are very big birds. I mean, they're enormous things, clunking around and doing whatever they're doing. So I thought that was it. But then my mother had a friend come for tea one day, and she was a sort of fortune teller, spirit medium person. And she said, "Oh, I can feel the presence of men in large boots marching about in the upper room." And I say my father confirmed that his grandmother, so we're going back to now the end of the 19th century, she used to let fishermen who were caught in the harbour by a storm and it wasn't their home port, she'd let them bunk down in the loft, the attic space, which was immediately above my bedroom. And of course, fishermen in that era wore great big thigh-length waders on them. And so we thought, well, maybe that was it. Maybe that was the clunking sound. But I suppose the spookiest thing for me was the fact, and again, it's one of those things at the time, you know, we're talking of a pre-teenage kid here, you don't really think much of it. But at the time, I'd often encounter a sensation at night that something was shaking the bottom of the bed. If you could imagine, someone was grabbing the bedboard at the bottom of the bed and giving it a tug. So the whole bed just went backwards and forwards a bit.
Yeah.
And again, I mentioned to my parents and they said, "Oh, just the wind hitting the house." And, you know, made sense because the house did stick out from the main property line. And if the wind came along, it would hit it. So I thought nothing about it. Yeah, that's fine. And it was only years later when we were actually selling the house and clearing it out and emptying the bedroom that it dawned on me that the way my bed was laid out, that if the wind had been hitting the house, I'd have surely been shaken from side to side rather than backwards and forwards. There was no way the wind could do that. So it remains this thing that was there something tugging at the bottom of my bed. But I say, it was a spooky house, but, you know, we're talking the 1950s when I was growing up, and, you know, we had coal fires and it just was a gloomier, darker age. And I suppose we, you know, television wasn't so prevalent. And, you know, winter, my parents and their friends would sit around an open fire and they'd be telling ghost stories and things that had happened to them and tales from their past. So I sort of grew up with this whole aura and interest in the paranormal, as we'd now call it, but, you know, ghosties and ghoulies and things that go bump in the night.
Now, the idea of the bed shaking didn't frighten you at all, Charles?
Well, no, because, you know, you're a bit innocent at that time. Your parents say, "It's just the wind." You say, "Oh, probably was." I mean, I must admit that I would pull the blankets over my head, shut my eyes tight, you know, just in case.
Sure,
you
know, sure, yes.
That thing you do when you see something scary on television, where you close your eyes, maybe put your hands over your face, because that'll keep anything horrible away. Always works.
Well, there's one of two reactions, and I find yours fascinating because, you know, when we're children, we either get scared of the unknown, of you know, what we think may be a ghost or and it sounds like in your household ghost stories were pretty common, and if your parents are talking about it like it's normal fare, well then of course it's acceptable. In my household, we didn't talk about things like that. It wasn't normal fare. I mean, if it was talked about, it was in hushed tones and whispers. And, oh, you know what? So-and-so did have an experience once, and it was kind of, you know, real, you know, it wasn't, not like it wasn't acceptable, but it was just, you know, it was kind of a, you know, we'll share the story between the two of us, and we'll keep it between the two of us. So I wonder if it's more talked about and out in the open, is it not as taboo a subject and something that it isn't as scary for a child?
I suppose it must be that. I mean, looking back, I probably grew up with a slightly dysfunctional family for some of the stories they told were distinctly X-rated, as in scary, as opposed to anything else. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't, you'd think twice about telling them today. But it was that era. I mean, I suppose one element was everybody still had in mind the Second World War and sort of, if you like, real horrors of people, you know, fishermen and things. You know, my father once commented that, you know, when he came back from the war, he was one of the few kids in his class who was still alive, if you like. You know, the rest had died, their ships had been sunk and so on. So I suppose there may have been a bit more almost escapism that, you know, we'll tell scary ghost stories because that's slightly less scary than the horrors of bombs dropping and people vanishing and being blown up and sort of terrible things happening that way.
Do you think it was more of, I hate to put it in this context, do you think it was more like gallows humor? Like you're sitting around and you have to find a way to deal with trauma because, as you pointed out, a lot of your parents' generation had survived World War II. They've gone through a traumatic time. And you're kind of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and now you've got to go on with life. You've got to figure out how to rebuild. You got to figure out how to go on with life and try to make things a better world and a happier world, yet you've dealt with this trauma. So is it a way of making that transition into a better life, especially for your children? Is that the way you make that transition?
I don't think that was really a conscious decision or thought by my parents. I think that may be a good modern interpretation of it, but you know, 1950s, people really didn't get into psychology or anything like that. You know, it really was certainly not in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was a conscious decision. I think it was just one of those strange things, the nature of the family. And, you know, they'd sit around in the twilight round a fire telling tales of, you know, experiences and encounters various people had had over the years. And my grandmother would tell tales of her mother and her grandmother and so on, you know, which is then taking us back into the middle of the 19th century. And I think there were just a bit more of an awareness of it. I think it's something they grew up and accepted, that there were ghosts and things in the world, rather than it being a gallows humor approach.
Okay. So obviously that talk that is in the family is that you're surrounded by obviously rubs off on you, and you decide that you want to kind of go off on your own and kind of explore some of this. And before ghost hunting was cool, I guess, in the 2000s and hit the televisions and podcasts and radio and all that other stuff, you set off to do some, I guess, for lack of a better term, ghost hunting of your own.
I did. When I was a teenager, we'd, you know, go out and go round graveyards late at night to see if there was anything to see. Mm-hmm. It was very much amateur ghost hunting by modern standards. You know, there was no technology involved at all. But later when I went to university, I did go on a few semi-organized ghost hunts where we would target a particular place and we would go there and spend some of the night there waiting to see what might happen. I had a friend with me who was a medical student who had a decent camera, as in could take pictures in the dark. Mm-hmm. And I was already writing stuff for university magazines and things. So I was taking my notepad with me and we'd sit there and with a flask of coffee and wait to see what happened. Sadly, nothing happened.
No?
No, we sat in many cold churchyards for a long time, but saw nothing of interest. But it was interesting to go round and visit the places and look at them. And they were just intriguing, just fascinating places. But, you know, and then when I moved to London as a law student, I went round Highgate Cemetery when this was in about 1970, when there was a scare, the Highgate vampire. And it was a big, another 3-day wonder, went on a bit longer than that in the UK. And there were reports supposedly of a vampire prowling in part of Highgate Cemetery, which in those days, there's two halves of Highgate Cemetery. There's a sort of well-organized, well-tended side that's open to the public all the time, where Karl Marx's grave is. And then there's the other side, which is Victorian, overgrown, spooky, a bit dangerous, tombs and catacombs and things, and mausoleum, all in various states of disrepair. And the vampire was supposedly in there. And it resulted in a mass vampire hunt where about 100 people one night climbed over the gates and went running around the place looking for vampires.
Really?
Yeah.
And this this vampire was undead, not like a live, blood-drinking, wanted, like our modern-day vampires just wanting to observe the ritual. This was an undead vampire.
This was supposedly an undead one, yes. I mean, with hindsight, you can now see that the two leading lights in this vampire hunt were both self-publicists, and indeed one of them has basically, for the last 50 years, he's still been telling stories about his vampire hunting days and writing books about it. But it attracted a lot of attention, and there does seem that there may have been a bit of crossover with reality in that there were some people practicing either black magic or Satanism, because it does seem some tombs were being despoiled and the human remains being taken out and desecrated and used in rituals and so on. So there's a bit of confusing fusion there. I know when I went there, and I'm not daft, I looking for a vampire in a graveyard, I went in broad daylight. But I did find a freshly opened tomb, and in it were the remains of a body that had been staked and then set fire to.
Oh my
God.
Say,
this is the early 1970s we're talking. So
yeah.
Whether this was somebody doing black magic or whether this was somebody thinking they were hunting vampires, but I say it was a phenomenon. And I say, as a result, that half of the cemetery is still now closed to the public, and you can only go there on organized tours so people don't get up to mischief.
Yeah.
But I say it's just one of those things that seem to appeal to me. You know, other people, I don't know, went to rock shows. I went to graveyards.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things. You know, you have your personal interests.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I spent my college years probably at those rock shows, like you said. I probably wore out my back and spine cheering for Van Halen. You were out there running after, you know, vampires. They both start with V. I don't know. I don't know what they have to, one and the other have in common. I tell you what, when we come back, I want to ask you what a chime child is and how it how it might have kept some of the supernatural activity away from you. Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest this evening is author Charles Christian. We are talking about, well, all kinds of things, really. We're talking about werewolf hunting. We're talking about ghosts. We're talking about the weird and the paranormal. We're also going to talk about the mysterious Wold-Newton Triangle. The book out there is The Mysterious Wold-Newton Triangle. That's the newest book out there by author Charles Christian. We'll talk a little bit about that a bit later. First, before the break, Charles, I teased a little bit about what a chime child is. Evidently, you are one of them. I think it's interesting that a chime child, if I understand it right, doesn't that have something to do with keeping the paranormal away from you?
I think it does. It supposedly gives you a form of protection. Some people say you can see the other world. You know, but others say actually it's more of a form of protection, and you can see and speak to ghosts and fairy folk and not risk anything happening to you. Oh. I mean, I think it's more a West Country in England form of folklore, and they were particularly keen on protection against fairy folk. And there's a lot of fairy lore about, you know, you mustn't step into the middle of a fairy ring. Yes. Or you mustn't accept gifts from the fae, because then you'll be beholden to them. And, you know, there's a lot of folklore about people who do that, and they think they've gone with the fairies for a night's dancing, and when they get back, 3 years have passed or whatever. So there was, well, still is in some parts, this concern that the fae were potentially dangerous, and that if you were a chime child, you had this protection against them, and that you could deal with them, and they couldn't attack you. As an actual chime child, it goes back to medieval times, when we didn't have clocks as such, but the local church would ring a bell at certain times, at sunrise, mid-morning, midday, mid-afternoon, early evening, and so on. And a chime child was generally a child that was born between midnight and about 3 a.m, which was one of the key chime hours in medieval timekeeping. And it was thought to be there was something special about people who were born during that period.
Interesting. So how, other than that prerequisite of being born at that time, how does one find out if they're a chime child? I mean, how does one find out if they have that special protection?
I don't know, actually. I mean, the assumption is that if you are born during that time, then you have the protection. And I suppose the only way you could ever find out is if you encountered a malevolent spirit or
just
something.
Jump into it, huh?
And see what happens, yes. As I say, it's another of those, it's a superpower I haven't had to use. And we have to see on that one.
Well,
it's intriguing. I think possibly one reason, obviously, is that the middle of the night, sort of three-ish, is actually also a time when probably more people die in their sleep for natural causes or ill health. Seems to be the body's at a low ebb. So there must be, I think there must be some sort of connection between people coming into the world at that time and people, and the fact that's when people go out of the world, and that perhaps you are some kind of liminal being. And obviously a lot of the folklore about the Fae and the like is that they are liminal beings, and that their world, the other world, the fairy world, is somehow parallel to ours. I think it's probably down to that.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like the veil is the thinnest at that low hour.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that must be it. I mean, it's one of those things. I didn't invent that bit of folklore. I'm merely taking advantage of the fact I appear to be benefiting from it.
Right. You know, you brought something up there in that you said you haven't had that encounter to find out. Have you had very many encounters with the paranormal?
Well, I've obviously,
I mean, other than the childhood
thing with the spooky bed.
Yeah.
But I didn't really recognize it as such. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm one of those people who's possibly blundering along looking for encounters with the paranormal. And all behind me, there's all manner of spooky beings. And I'm looking in the opposite direction, missing them or something. That's why I give the M.R. James quote. I've never encountered anything that would say that was a paranormal encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm open-minded enough to accept that there probably is a paranormal world out there. It's just that I haven't encountered it in a way that I could put my hand on my heart and say that was a true paranormal experience.
Well, and the reason I ask some of these questions, and I've brought this up on the show before, so it's nothing that my audience doesn't know about, but I've had encounters with shadow people on investigations, but they run from me. So, which is odd.
Ah, right.
I've had investigators and seasoned investigators and seasoned haunted location owners tell me they've never seen a shadow people run from them, or any shadow people run from them. It's not something they do. They don't take off in the other direction and just disappear.
Perhaps you're a Chime Child as well.
See, that's when I saw that on the bio, Chime Child, I went, what exactly is a Chime Child? But I was born at 8:26 in the morning on my side of the world. But on your side of the world, that's the middle of the afternoon. Or actually, that's evening. That's evening. Let me think here.
Where we are, it's 6 hours difference. So,
right. That's evening.
Mid-afternoon, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, time-wise, it doesn't fit, but, you know, but still there's that extra protection there for me.
Yes.
When I walk into haunted locations, which can be frustrating because I do walk in wanting to see that activity, but I'll get EVPs where I'll walk in with a recorder and I'll want to catch something, and I'll stand there and I'll get nothing on a recorder. And then I'll have a team with me or a team of friends with me. And I'll say, you know what? I'm going to go walk in the other room. You guys go ahead and you collect. And I'll get a ghost or a spirit or a malevolent spirit that will start swearing up a storm and say it wants to kill me. It'll say that goddamn Dennis. And I've had friends come home and not review their evidence and then call me up on the phone and say, you got to hear this. And it'll call me out by name saying that it wants to kill me. And I'm saying, why didn't you play that when we were there? That would have been great. But I have to walk away so that it'll play it, which is just amazing. So I think it's fascinating that there's actually a term for that.
Yeah. I'm still pondering over your time zone thing, trying to see if I can work a way that it would work. But
unless I go back in time.
Yeah.
I have no idea, but it's fascinating nonetheless to hear, you know.
Well, you know, you get people who say that they are sensitive and they can detect things. It's logical that there are also people who can repel things. Mm-hmm. You know, that they're sensitive in a negative way. You know, you're anti-kryptonite or whatever. You know,
I get it's not a bad thing. I mean, if there's some malevolent spirit that's pulling here and scratching people, I'm not the one who's going to get it, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all.
Not at all. So let's talk a little bit about the Wold-Newton triangle and yes. How you came upon it and how you learned about it. How did you learn about this Wold-Newton triangle?
This again goes back to my childhood and teenage years. And we, as a family, would go out, as people did in those days, on a Sunday afternoon in the car for a drive in the countryside. And one of the areas we used to go to was this area called the Yorkshire Wolds, which is south of Scarborough. And we'd go to various places and I'd learn the history about them and, you know, get the books and so on. And again, listen to tales from the family and so on. And it was, again, much later, once I started writing again on folklore and legends, because for most of the sort of adult career, the day job, I was a tech journalist and legal journalist. So I was writing worthy but a little bit dull stuff. And I'm now in a position where I can write the fun stuff that I've always wanted to write. And, mm-hmm. you know, I sort of slightly missed out on the timings. There weren't really any career openings in paranormal research when I was leaving college, sort of thing. But I was putting it all together and I realized I'd got this mosaic of incidents and stories, and they were all within a closed area. And when you look at it on a map, because the sea's on one side and there's a very large headland, and so you've got two sides to the headland, it actually creates a giant triangle. And the center of this is Wold-Newton. And so I christened it the Wold-Newton Triangle. And the book is basically a tour that takes you around it. And all the various weird tales and stories that can be found lying within that triangle. And it just struck me as, you know, as this sort of epicenter of weirdness. And, you know, little things that you pick up here and there, you don't think about too much at the time, but then you realize the significance of them. And, you know, there's a churchyard there in a place called Rudston, and the new book has the image of this churchyard on the front cover. And there is an enormous monolith there, been there for 4,000 plus years. And although a lot of it is now beneath the ground, it is far taller than any of the stones at Stonehenge. It's the largest, tallest single standing stone in the entire UK. And it's just there. And it's, you know, interesting insight onto the early Christians there, mm-hmm. that this was clearly a ritual site. So they built their church right next to it to say, you know, you've always come to this ritual site to pray. We're no longer praying to Odin. We're praying to Jesus now. And indeed, at one point, they stuck a cross on the top of this monolith.
Really?
And I say, when you see it on it's just slap next to the church. It's the most incongruous looking thing, you know, cute little medieval church, you know, primitive stone age monolith all together in the same theme park. You know? So it's intriguing, but that's there. And then, raking through the folklore, there's a lot of huge amount of burial mounds, tumuli or barrows and things, hundreds of them there. A lot of the smaller ones have been lost to ploughing, but there are still the remains of some big ones there that were high status burial grounds that are, you know, when they've been excavated from the things that have been found there, and just the sheer effort gone into building them. There was some kind of ritual landscape going back thousands of years and right through to what presumably ended with the Romans coming and destroying the sort of Celtic culture that was there. But, you know, it was clearly for 2,000 plus years, this hugely important ritual landscape. And I just found it fascinating that nobody's heard of it. You know, in the UK, we all talk about Stonehenge and things like that. Right. But this place is equally worthy of coverage.
What is, I'm just, for my own curiosity, what's the oldest grave marker in that area? Do you know? I mean,
not in terms of grave markers. I mean, there's burial mounds going back 4,000 years.
Right, right.
There's not far from there, and I cover them in the book. There used to be a lake village going back probably about 10,000 years ago when the country was still drying out after the ice ages. And, they built wooden platforms to fish from and to live on, which has the claim to being the oldest carpentry in Europe, the woodwork that's been found. And they also found a whole group of masks. They're made out of red deer. They call them frontlets. It's the front of the skull of a red deer. And they hack off the horns a bit to make it a bit more manageable, bore a couple of holes in the front for eye holes. And quite clearly, they then wore these skulls over the front of their faces in presumably some kind of shamanistic ritual before they went hunting red deer, which, you know, for the people in what's now England of that time, the red deer was a source of meat, of skin for hide, for clothing, sinew, bones for working into fishing spears and so on and so forth. So, you know, and again, those go back 8,000 years. So, we're dealing with some really ancient culture in this area.
The reason I guess I ask that question is it fascinates me to wonder who was the first in that area, not necessarily in the world, but in that area, to want to remember somebody by etching in, whether it be by wood, by stone, by whatever, and to put that in the ground, not just a marker to remember or to plant wood into ground or stone into ground, or any material into ground to remember that somebody was placed there, that they had put somebody in the ground there, but to actually etch a name into that marker so that they'd be remembered.
There's nothing but the people of pre-Roman Britain, it was a largely non-literate culture that went by oral traditions. It's the same with the Druids, who were the priestly caste that used to predominate in the time of the Britons, say, before the Romans came. And they also had a oral culture. And, you know, they would learn the poetry, they would learn the tales, but they were never written down. So there's this huge gap in the culture. And, they had gold coins as their currency, but they were really copies of European coins, and the writing didn't necessarily make sense. It was only, you know, when the Romans came and Latin started to be used. So it was a pre-literate culture. So we're left with all these clues, but with no names, no identifying tags, no documents, no, or anything of that nature. The best you can do is archaeological evidence of burial mounds and charcoal testing and dating evidence to look back. But I say it's a fascinating thing. I mean, one of the things that's been discovered in the last couple of years, although there were a few more some years previous to that, as finding these quite substantial stone drums is the only word for it. They were round discs that would look like a child's drum set, except they're made of stone. And there's been a number of burials found with these items with them. And one theory is that if you put a piece of cord around one of these drums, it gives a measurement that was a measurement that was used by the people of that time for building purposes. And they, you know, they look at some of the proportions on Stonehenge and things, and they've discovered that there are certain measurements used, the long foot and, you know, certain distances. And it's thought that perhaps these drum-like things, there was some kind of mathematical involvement. But again, you know, you put the rope round twice and you'd got two measurements, so two units of measurement. Mm-hmm. If it was three times round, it was three measures, and so on. Right. But again, we're all on speculation, because there's no written evidence and nothing left to fill in the details. But I say that in terms of tombs with names on them, nothing in that area from the way back has survived.
Sure. What do you suppose the earliest would be? Would it be a couple thousand years ago?
It would be a couple of thousand years ago once the Romans came, because they were great ones for, because obviously they had Latin and, you know, they had a literature and carvings. And so, for example, there's gravestones that have been found within Hadrian's Wall up in the north of England, and in carvings on Roman ruins and things. So you start getting that, and then it starts spreading across into the local population, as well as, you know, the Romano-British population, and literacy starts spreading. I mean, where I am now in East Anglia, not far from here, there is a Roman town called Venter Iconorum, which was a town the Romans set up after they defeated Queen Boudica and her tribe, who were the Iceni. And they found there, in the nearby river, lots of curse tablets, and they're written on lead, and you scratch them on, and people would use them to place curses on people. And then you'd fold over the lead, so it was like an envelope, and you'd throw it into the water for a water god to recover and to bring the curse about. And it was such a big business that archaeologists have found blanks that have been prepared by local craftsmen with the engraving on, and basically the scribe inserts your name and who you want to curse and what remedy you want and what you want back from them and what you're going to give the god in return. And it's things like, if you curse the person who stole my clothing and it's returned to me, I will give the god a pair of my trousers.
I can't think it's too healthy either to be throwing lead into the water, especially if your tribe is drinking out of it. I don't know.
Well, we used to have lead water pipes until relatively recently.
That's true. That's true. We all were kind of living free and crazy, weren't we?
Yeah. Yes.
That's true.
There was a lot of lead around. It was the silicon chip of the Roman world.
It was. You said you noticed in this Wold-Newton triangle that there was an area of activity within it. What other types of activity were going on?
Well, I say there were ghost stories, probably no more than you'd expect, but some interesting ghost stories there.
I'm curious, Charles, in this country, we're relatively, I know the rebel kids over here in the West, we're a relatively young country, so our ghosts are relatively, you see period ghosts of different periods. If you go to the eastern part of the U.S., you may see a colonial ghost, or you go to the west part of the U.S., you may see a cowboy, you may see whatever you see. I'm curious, when you go to an area like the Wold-Newton Triangle, do you see a druid ghost? Do you see a period ghost?
You don't see any druid ghosts, and that sort of raises that whole idea of residual ghosts on whether eventually they wear out, and it does seem to be that it's interesting that you don't get many ancient ghosts around.
Right.
Whereas logically you should do if ghosts exist forever. Mm-hmm. And, if you accept the view that they are somehow ghosts, some types of ghosts are really recordings on the environment, on stones or whatever, perhaps they do wear out over time and have a limited number of plays. In the Wold-Newton Triangle, there's a cavalier ghost from the English Civil War, 17th century, that's seen walking across one of the roads. And there's a village called Flamborough, and that has three ghosts. One's a woman in white who's believed to have been a Saxon maiden who was abandoned by her Viking lover. It's all very dramatic. And then there's two other ones, and the saying is, if I can get the exact words of it.
Sure.
It said, one of them goes by the name of Jenny Gallows and wears an old-fashioned poke bonnet on her head. Hmm. That's sort of Regency style. And the other one, who walks around with her, possesses neither a bonnet nor a head to put it on. And Jenny Gallows lurks in a well. And it's one of those stories that if you go round the well, run round it 9 times, you will hear fairies. But on the 8th lap, the ghost of Jenny Gallows rises up from the well and cries out, "I'll tie on me bonnet, I'll put on me shoe, and if thou's not off, I'll soon catch you." And there's a tale of somebody doing that and being chased all the way back to his house by this malevolent ghost.
Really? That's quite the tale. That's quite the tale. Now, there's also a Wold Newton meteorite. And what's it got to do with superheroes?
I'm a huge this is a wonderful story. Too, so. Again, it's one of these that you think of all the places in the world, and it's a particularly obscure area, and it's probably fair to say there are less people living in this part of the world now than there were 100 years ago, with, you know, no longer large agricultural population. You know, one man and a tractor does what team of 10 did with horses, sort of thing. Philip Jose Farmer, who wrote a series of sci-fi novels during the 60s and 70s, one of the things he did was he wrote some fictional biographies of people like Tarzan. Okay. And, you know, who were his family and so on. Mm-hmm. And switching back to the Wold Newton meteorite, this was a real event in about 1795 when a meteorite was actually seen crashing down, and it nearly hit somebody so close and crashed into the earth. And at the time, it was the largest meteorite that had ever landed in the UK. And obviously was a cause célèbre because normally they go into sea and aren't sea. So, and the local squire of the area at Wold Newton, he landed on his land. So he exhibited it and took it down to London and charged people a penny a time to look at it and so on. Anyway, you can still see the meteorite in the Science Museum in London. But anyway, so there was this historical fact, and Philip Jose Farmer took the view that created the historical fiction that when the meteorite came down, there were a couple of carriages of people traveling by, and they were all affected by the radiation from this meteorite that crashed down. And these people included Mr. Darcy from the Jane Austen novel, included the ancestors of Sherlock Holmes, the ancestors of Tarzan, included the Scarlet Pimpernel, who was fighting the French Revolution and so on, and a whole raft of people, and their servants were involved, and some of their servants then went on to become villains. An ancestor of James Bond and Blofeld were involved, and all of these people all stem from this one incident, and all their powers and their everything that goes on is all a result that they were exposed to this meteorite way back then.
Really?
I say it was again one of those things you think of all the places to pick, it's this spot right in the middle. You know, what are the chances?
Yeah, exactly. It's a strange little area, that's for sure. That's for sure. Just want to remind people as we're talking here to Charles. Charles Christian is our guest, and we're talking to him right now. The book we're talking about is the newest book he has out there, The Mysterious Wold Newton Triangle. His website is urbanfantasist.com, or fantastist
is what? Fantasist. Yes. Urban fantasist, yes.
I put the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable there, Charles. urbanfantasist.com. We'll have a link in the description of the show. We were talking earlier about werewolves. There's a demon hound. Is this in the same area? The Black Shuck?
No, this is where I live now. And this is the book Shuckland, which is came out last year, and mm-hmm. is about the Waveney Valley, the East Anglia. And this again is a story that's got legs and has grown and grown and grown, and starts with an incident back in the middle of the 16th century, when there's a thunderstorm and people are taking shelter in the local parish church in a nearby town called Bungay. And people did this because most of them lived in thatched cottages, and thatched cottages are rather prone to catching fire if they're hit by lightning, whereas churches had lead roofs or slate roofs and were a safe place to be. Anyway, it's dark, there's a thunderstorm rattling, and somehow, suddenly, there's this flash of lightning, and people are being thrown down dead or horribly mutilated. And the story is this giant hellhound. No one's quite sure whether it was a large dog or a demon or what, but it's generally called a hellhound, great black hellhound, bit like a werewolf in description with big red glowing eyes and so on, comes running down the aisle of the church, killing people all over the place, and then disappears, only to reappear few minutes later, about 20 miles away at another church, where it does exactly the same thing and also brings down the spire of the church and again kills people. And this second church, they will still point to burn marks on the door of the church and say those were made by its red hot paws as it was, the demon hound was leaving. And again, it was a huge thing. And it's become part of East Anglia's folklore. And there are endless stories about Black Shuck, as it is called, and lots of sightings of it, and right through to the present day. And indeed, there is currently plans to start an annual Black Shuck festival, which will no doubt lead to more sightings of the demon hound.
Now, There's a couple of different things that you deal with regarding John Paul Jones. Can you tell us a little bit about John Paul Jones? Especially, there's an American connection here somewhere having to do with Thanksgiving turkeys.
Well, there's two. Yes, just near within the Wole-Newton Triangle, there is a stately home and still occupied actually by descendants of the original people there who built it. And there's a church, and the church pulpit is decorated with turkeys. And the story is the squire of the house sailed on one of the early visits to the United States, to North America, and brought back the first turkeys to England. So sometime in the late 16th century, this would be. And the character in question claimed, he was the navigator who found the first turkeys and brought them back. And certainly the people there, they built up a huge fortune on the turkey business and helped establish it as a food source. I mean, the reality is he was probably a cabin boy, and his role was to feed the turkeys or not let them get too seasick. But yes, I say that was an intriguing thing, that Thanksgiving turkeys and the Christmas turkey, which is more how we have them in the UK, again, starts here with the first mass farming of turkeys. And the character in question even had a large tower built so he could sit up there and look down and see his turkeys on grazing on the land around him, and see the various ships coming into a nearby harbor to collect turkeys or bring in more turkeys. But say the John Paul Jones, this is Flamborough Head and a battle that took place there. And during the American Revolution, where John Paul Jones was on the Bonhomme Richard, and he and some French allies, although when you read the accounts of the battle, they were probably allies you'd rather not have with you because they got in the way a lot of the time, and their cannon shooting caused probably more harm to their own side than to the enemy. But anyway, he got involved in a big sea battle there, and that is the famous battle where he, says, "Surrender, I have not even begun to start fighting," all the famous quotes from. Mm-hmm. And he fought this battle there, and it's particularly well known because it was so close to the headland that all the people in the nearby town sort of went up there with their picnics and sat on the top of the headland and watched the battle going on just a few miles out to sea. And as the story goes, he eventually captured the, I think it was the Serapis, the lead ship of the English flotilla, and took that over for himself. But the Bonhomme Richard was so badly damaged that it drifted out to sea and sank a few days later. And so far, nobody's ever found the wreck of it. There's a vague idea where it may be, but it's never been discovered. But again, it was just another coincidence. This famous battle took place at the apex of the Wall-Newton Triangle, one of the apexes of it.
It's crazy. It's crazy that there's that much activity in that small area of the world. Okay, I got to bring it up because it's the elephant in the room when we talk about your area of the world. In your folklore, and I think the thing that draws especially us on this side of the world to your area of the world is the legend and lore of dragons, and especially when we in America come up with folklore of your area of the world, dragons are one of the first things we dream about. I mean, you look at Game of Thrones. Let's talk about the first thing we throw in there is a huge fire breathing dragon. So Charles, I guess the first question I want to throw out there is, how come we never find dragon bones, and what exactly are dragons? I mean, we talk about dragons all the time, but what exactly are they, and why are they so prominent in folklore?
Well, it's an intriguing question, that, because it's prevalent in so much folklore. It's prevalent in English folklore, is prevalent in European folklore, it crops up in the Bible. There's a whole range of saints who kill dragons, St. George being one of the best known ones. Dragons crop up in the Far East. The Japanese, the Koreans, the Chinese, they all have dragons in their folklore, and they all have slightly different variations of the dragon and the details. And they even crop up in Central America, the Quetzalcoatl and the Aztec flying creatures and things are essentially dragons. And you've got the Native Americans with thunderbirds, which are huge, big, flying creatures. I just find it very intriguing that there are so many tales around, and there's something, obviously deep down inside us that we all recognize it and we seem to know what it is. Apart from, long time pre Game of Thrones, it's in Tolkien, the dragons in there in The Hobbit. It's such a major feature. And, why is it such a common thing? Is it because, you say we don't find dragon bones, but we do find dinosaur bones.
Right.
And, if you're a medieval peasant digging in a mine and you found a Tyrannosaurus Rex skull and you dragged it out and showed it to the local priest, who would be the only person you'd know who could read and write, he's bound to say, it's a demon or something, a beast from the Revelations. He's going to give it a biblical dragon-like interpretation. And there's a number of places in Europe where the churches proudly own dragon bones, which, you know, modern paleontologists and the like, and geologists and archaeologists can identify as either dinosaur bones or whale bones or some other large creature bone. So I think there's an element of these big things were being dug out of the ground and they've been lost to history, you know, because we only think of dinosaurs in the last 100 years, 150 years. So, so, you know, how they interpreted them in the past would be in biblical terms as dragons rather than as an extinct creature. And then there's all the real life creatures that we have that get, you know, people come back again, going back, you know, a few hundred years, people come back from long sea voyages and they're describing some creatures they've seen. Komodo dragons, saltwater crocodiles, which can grow to an enormous size and look very, very evil and menacing. Probably earlier times, Roman times, because they were great ones for shipping animals over from Africa to put in the Colosseum and in on show and in gladiatorial contests and things. There may well have been other crocodile, alligator type creatures being brought over. And I think all of those add to the myth of it. And, you know, there's something innately evil and alien about large crocodiles. And, you know, you look at them in a zoo or something. I remember seeing one in an aquarium in Australia. It was a saltwater crocodile and it was just floating there. It had, you know, a big glass wall between us and his. It was just this enormous thing and it was just staring at everybody and it just looked evil.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah, they can. And I think that may well be what it is, that, you know, fantasy and reality have got blurred and it's just continued down through the centuries, you know. And
do you think it is too that in the, especially in different cultures, as you pointed out, when it comes to a dragon in a classic sense, a dragon can have a duplicitous nature. It can either be docile and serving, or in one sense, or in another, it can be rageful, attacking, evil, or perceived evil, and wields fire. We look at it as almost the devil-like character, the rage that we've always wanted to represent or let go. So it can be good or evil. It can be used for either purpose. So therefore, it's the perfect character to put into any situation. Is that fair to say?
I think that is very fair to say, you know. And, you know, when you read some parts of the Bible, the Beast of Revelations, and when you get into fairly fantastical descriptions, these things would appear to be manifestations of that. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, going back to crocodiles and things, they are very much like that. You know, they spend a lot of time just lying there looking like they're fast asleep, but then they can, quick as lightning, grab something, roll over, drown it, eat it, and cart it away. Mm-hmm. You know, one moment they're docile and apparently not doing anything. The next moment they're unleashed as a terrible killer.
Right.
So, you know, I think that is a factor there.
Yeah, I think that a lot of fascinations with dragons are just that. It's the fact that we can either side with it or be afraid of it, and there is a healthy dose of fear with it and fascination, and I think that's what keeps people coming back to it in folklore. So, how exactly do you get rid of one?
Well, again, I haven't been on a dragon hunt, I would, for the benefit of your colleague. But it's interesting to read the methods people use. I mean, St. George ran it through with a spear, and there's a whole Christian take on dragons that they can be made docile by putting a virgin's girdle, which is a belt, basically, around the dragon's head, and they become docile, and you can lead them along with it. But you know, other methods are more elaborate, and they include poisoning a sheep, and then the dragon eats the sheep and then eats the poison and dies. And more elaborate still, that they've got some kind of tar in them that the dragon's flames will set fire to. So when they eat it, the thing explodes. My favorite one, which is from the Wold Newton book, there's a rocky outcrop that goes off the headland into the sea called Filey Brick, a town called Filey. And it's this long rock outflow. And the legend is that those are actually dragon bones, and that the dragon used to plague the town and run around the place, burning things up here, there, and everywhere. And so the locals got a large dish of parkin, which is P-A-R-K-I-N, which is a north of England treacly, gingery sponge cake.
Okay.
It's very tasty, but it's also quite gluey. And it's the sort of thing that if you eat it, you've immediately got to go and clean your teeth because it's everywhere. Mm. And the story is the dragon greedily ate all this stuff and got it all in its teeth and got caught with it, so went down into the water to try and rinse its teeth out. And while it was busy doing that, the locals crept up on it and killed it, and its bones remained there. But I say this is an interesting thing where folklore and real life coincide, because a few miles down the coast, really in the same bay as Filey Brig, but sort of the southern end of it, they have discovered plesiosaur fossil bones.
Really?
In the cliffs there. So lo and behold, a large dinosaur, water-going dinosaur, has been found there, and there's a legend. And so you wonder, well, maybe that came out first and people had seen this and thought, that's a dragon we've got there, and somehow it then got confabulated with the brig that those were dragon bones as well, and the tales merge. I mean, that's one of the interesting things, that no matter how fantastical some folklore stories are, if you scratch the surface, somewhere in the depths there's a true element to give it. I mean, you know, I went back, go back to old Stinker the Werewolf.
Mm-hmm.
In 1066, which is famous in English history for the Battle of Hastings and the Normans beating the Saxons. But prior to that, and one of the reasons why the Saxons were in such disorder, is they had to fight an invasion of Vikings who landed in the early part of 1066. And they landed at a town called Scarborough, my hometown, and some of them sailed around the coast, up a large river, and others went overland. And one of the leaders of the Vikings was a berserker. And berserkers, as anybody who's watched the Viking TV series, are people who, warriors who psych themselves up that they've got the spirit of a wild animal in them. And berserkers are the wild animal is a bear, and they would often, from accounts, would go into battle wearing just a bear skin, possibly nothing else, and a big sword or axe, and just be unstoppable killing machines. But there were also another type who were and it's a Scandinavian word with lots of U's and I's and L's and F's, basically U for, but they were wolf people, and they would go in with a wolf skin. And so we've got this tale of old Stinker, a werewolf that is half man, half wolf, or wolf, part man. And then we've got this battle at 1066 and this army of men who would have been splattered in blood because they'd already fought when they'd landed at Scarborough and burned things down, marching along there, wearing wolf pelts on them. And I just wonder whether, again, we've got a mixture of fact and reality. And look, Dad, you're a Saxon peasant hiding for your life. And are those men or are those wolves or are they wolf men, werewolves, which, you know, is the name of it. So, right. Again, there's a historical event which could possibly then over hundreds of years of folklore and development give rise to the werewolf.
Right, exactly. Yeah, fascinating stuff. I mean, you're right. It's a mixture, as you say, sometimes of reality and fantasy and people trying to find a way to literate what they're seeing, but putting it in a way that people can understand, people of the day can understand, and how we translate it even, you know, hundreds of years later. I find it fascinating how we put together stories and how it's translated many, many years later. Although it's hard not to translate what a ghost is or what a werewolf is how things change under the moonlight. So you wonder whether, you know, sometimes fantasy is fantasy or whether it's reality.
Yes. I mean, you mentioned ghosts, and I mean, that is, if you like, the exception, because people since, certainly in the West, ancient Greek times, have had ghosts that pretty much coincide with modern depictions of ghosts and accounts of ghosts. So that there is that element of it, and you makes you think, well, ghosts do exist.
Right.
It just so happens I've never seen one.
Right. And there's some things
But I'm happy to accept that they do exist. And I say the fact so many people have had these experiences, it's not just a handful. It's in so many different cultures, and people who are, if you like, not fanciful at all. You know, you meet some people and the slightest thing, it's, that's a spirit or something, you know, they're a bit over the top. But, you know, down-to-earth people who wouldn't be prone to flights of fancy, they still have the same sensations and the same experiences.
Right. It's funny how, you know, reality and fantasy is just a slight step to the right of reality. Fantasy is based in reality. There has to be some reality to base fantasy on. There has to be some building block to build that off of.
I mean, that's what I think it is. You know, it's not that somebody once sat down and said, I'm going to write a story about a big flying lizard that breathes flames. No, there was something else before that.
Right.
That was the touchstone for it.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, it has to come from some inspiration. So I think you're right. There's different origins for where the literature, the folklore comes from, but we don't have to look so far as to see where it came from. And so that a story like what you just told us from 1066 is there's sure to be some roots in reality, that's for sure. So Charles, people can go to your website, which we'll have a link in the description, but it is Urban Fantasist, not Fantasist.
That's it.
Yes.
Urban Fantasist.
UrbanFantasist.com. You've got more than just the new book out there, The Mysterious Wold Newton Triangle. You've got Shuckland out there, A Travel Guide to Yorkshire's Weird Worlds, The Mysterious Wold Newton Triangle, Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England, and Creating Imaginary Worlds, The 12 Rules. Did I get them all there?
You have indeed, yeah. And great. Currently working on some other books.
Okay.
One's stuck in development hell, but should be out later this year, which is a sort of A to Z of witches and sorcerers, but taken from history.
Oh,
and right. Brief biographies and setting them into context and so on. And that'll be out with an American publisher, hopefully by Halloween. But
sounds good. Can people get autographed copies of your books at your website?
They can indeed. The best method is to message me and I will deal with it, because if it goes through Amazon, then I can't do that, but I can certainly supply them, and I'm quite happy to send them over, send them to the US.
Sounds
happy
good.
To do that.
Sounds good.
And there's ebook versions. If you don't want the paperback, there's ebook versions of them all as well.
All right. Sounds wonderful. Charles Christian has been our guest. Again, urbanfantasist.com is the website. We'll have a link to it in the description of our program. Charles, thank you so much for being on the program.
Tim, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Folks, I want to thank you so much for being with us this week. Take care of yourself and each other this weekend as you're out and about. If you see somebody in need, maybe somebody is out there looking like they're having a tough time, or maybe they just need an extra hand with something, go ahead and help them out. You know, the world's been a little darker, a little colder, and it seems to be getting that way a little bit each day, each week. Let's do something for one another. Take an extra minute or two to reach out and help somebody, and let's get the world back on track. Let's help each other out a little bit more and be a little bit more friendly towards each other as we go on in life. And let's get back on track, get the world back on track, and let's put a little light into the darkness, shall we? For Beer City Bruiser, for Mally Fox, for Jessica Freeberg, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for tuning in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This has been Darkness Radio.